Hi, welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
We used to work as many as 7 or 8 or even 9 days straight without a day off. But I think that was a bit silly from everybody's point of view, especially ours, because it just meant that you were... The ideal thing, actually, is what we do in Europe, which is to play 3 on, 1 off. But that's allowing for the necessity of travelling through borders into different countries. And in the States, we sort of average about 4 on, 1 off. And that's a comfortable sort of a level. But once you're several weeks into a tour, you find that when that one day off comes up, that you actually feel a little shattered, to put it mildly, because, you know, it is physically very tiring doing concerts, and as long as you keep rolling, you don't feel the pain. But once you have a day off, you wake up in the morning, or usually the morning after a day off, and you really feel stiff and sore because you haven't kept yourself physically on that plane that you need to be on in order to keep up that kind of level of energy, really. So a day off is a mixed blessing. It's a chance to do the laundry. It's also a chance to realize just how tired you are. If you're on tour for 3 months, everybody is going to get sick sometime, because traveling in aeroplanes and being with so many people all the time, you pick up some alien bug to which you don't have a resistance, and it just spreads through the crew and through the group, and everybody comes down with it. But we all got it in sort of towards the end of the German part of the European tour, and I got mine in Switzerland and Italy. And that was probably the best place to have it, because the Italians don't notice. Because the Italians are a cheerful bunch, you know, and they just really wouldn't notice if I was a bit kind of head coldish and not really on form, because they're just having a good time anyway, just being there. So they're a good bunch to have a cold with if you have to have one. For years and years, it wasn't just us. Pretty well every rock band that went to Italy got embroiled in some kind of fracas, usually involving lots of police, tear gas, rubber bullets, and a few thousand people going a bit crazy. But it's sort of calmed down a bit. We still actually play under the communist flag in some parts of Italy anyway. Because the local Communist Party are frequently involved in the sponsorship and the organisation of concerts. And you actually play under a red flag. In fact, not this year, but the year we did some outdoor shows in Italy, and there was a red communist flag in every dressing room, every caravan. And in fact, I took mine. I asked politely if I could have it as a souvenir, because my son goes to a fairly... smart English boarding school where, you know, they're taught to be young gentlemen and embrace the capitalist way of life and all the rest of it. And I thought it'd be quite fun for him to have a communist flag to hang up in his dormitory. But predictably, when he got back to school with it, it was immediately impounded by the history master, because the history master wanted it to hang up in the history room next to his swastika and some other sort of various slightly dubious bits of... flag that he thought were, useful to have in the context of showing the young pupils the various facts of life in terms of political history and so on and so forth. So, in fact, since I've spoken to you, we've been to Italy twice, and I'm very sad to report that we haven't been tear gassed on either of those occasions. I don't know what, it's things aren't what they used to be there. So.
Understanding.
Yes, it's sad, of course, that these things don't necessarily endure forever, whereas Martin Barr, the guitar player who's been with the band for all but its first formative 8 months when Mick Abrahams was the guitarist, apart from Martin, I mean, all the other guys obviously have changed, and in most cases they don't play music anymore. In fact, someone was just asking me about John Evans and what he was doing, and I in fact called him when we were making, or just when I was finishing off the last bits of Rock Island. I was stuck for a couple of piano bits because I played keyboards on most of it, and so I rang up John Evans out of the blue and said, "Hey, you know, fancy coming and playing on a couple of tracks?" And he said, "Well, I'm a bit tied up, a bit busy, you know, because he runs a building firm now. He builds houses or something, you see." And he said, I just don't have the time. And anyway, I haven't played the piano now for 4 years, wow. Which I hadn't realised. I mean, I've spoken to him a few times, but I just hadn't realised that he literally had not played at all. And I said, "Well, tell you what, John, you know, okay, we can't do this time, no problem. Why don't you practice a bit of piano, maybe come and play on another record, or, you know, maybe come and sit in with the band sometime playing a show." And he really just didn't want to do it. I mean, he didn't say, "No, I don't want to do that," but you could tell, as you can always tell, when someone just really just doesn't want to go through that again. And same with Geoffrey Hammond. I mean, when John Glasscock, the bass player that succeeded Geoffrey on, I think about 75, 76, when John Glasscock tragically died of complications following heart surgery, we asked Geoffrey to come back, and even if only temporarily, because we knew he didn't want to be full-time in the band, we asked him to come back and you know, play a tour. But again, you know, it was just something he just said, "No, I just don't want to go back to do it anymore. I've done it for whatever it was, in his case, 3 or 4 years, 4 or 5 years, and I just don't want to do that anymore. I now have another life, and it was great to do it, but that's it." I mean, I'm very fortunate in the sense that I've been through all of that, you know, the feelings of I've done it, I don't want to do it anymore, but I got it out of my system in 1972, was the only time I'd really had enough and decided that I'd really just wanted to stop. As of course I didn't. I, you know, whatever the problems were at the time, I got over and carried on. But, I mean, I'm very fortunate in the sense that I've got an ongoing musical life, which is important to me. It's not one that I would desperately not want to give it up. But at the same time, it's not the only thing that I do, and therefore, in the global perspective of my life, music is a very important but not the only point, which makes it all the more valuable because it's an important component part. It doesn't become so horrendously, totally dominating in everything that I do. It's something that I can now relish and look forward to when I'm doing it without it ever getting to the point where I'm sick of it. You know, I'm sure that if it was the only thing I had in life, then it would be very much a love-hate relationship by now. I would sort of be unable to stop, but at the same time I'd probably hate it, you know.
9 miles of two strand topped with barbed wire, laid by the father for the son. Good shelter down there valley floor, down by where the sweet stream run. Now they might give me compensation, that's not what I'm chasing. I was a rich man before yesterday, now all I have got is a check and a pickup truck. And I left my farm on the freeway. That busy building airports on the south side, silicon chip factory on the east, and the big roads pushing through along the valley floor. Machine born in 6 lanes at the very least. Now, they say they gave me compensation, that's not what I'm chasing. I was a rich man before yesterday, and all I have left is a broken down pickup looks like my farm is a freeway.
Hi, welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
Writing songs for me is a distillation of perhaps a couple of years worth of little ideas and notions that are floating around in my head. I don't write anything down, but when I go in on the appointed hour, on the appointed day to start work on material for a new record, then I don't go in with an empty head. I'm going in with a whole bunch of things that are just sort of waiting to come out. And normally speaking, I mean, I would probably go in about 8, 9 in the morning, because I like to start fairly early. And by lunchtime, I'd probably have two or three things on the go. And after lunch, I would then probably home in on one of those things, the thing that looked most promising, and concentrate on that for the afternoon. By the end of the afternoon, then I would have something resembling a song, you know, some few lines of lyrics and a, you know, verse, chorus, beginning and end, middle, eight, or whatever, you know, some part, some basic structure. Then I would take after coming up with a number of those pieces, you know, perhaps 10 of those pieces over a 10-day period. But then I would sit down with Martin Barr and Dave Pegg, the guitarist and bass player in the band, and we'd sit down and work those out into a roughed out arrangement that we can then work on with all the band, with a view to getting a backing track recorded, perhaps after another 2 or 3 days of rehearsal. So it's a growing process. I mean, I don't demo songs, and I don't write them out in terms of detailed arrangements, or very rarely do I do that. It's a roughed out song that has an identity as a song, but is just then ready to move on to the next stage. But there's normally a failure rate of about 50%. In other words, the things that I take to the guys in the group and say, well, here's an idea for a song, about half of them just don't make it onto the record. You know, they fall apart either at an early stage of rehearsal or at some point during the recording process. I mean, usually before it gets recorded. I mean, usually at the end of, you know, when you're about ready to roll the tape, as it were, you think, no, this doesn't really make it anyway. So about half of them fall by the wayside. But on this particular album, I think probably 8 out of the 10 pieces that I did to begin with actually ended up on the record, and I only had to do a couple more during the actual process of recording the album did I need to find a couple more ideas. It's a fairly quick process, but, I mean, after all, we're not writing symphonies, you know, we're not dealing with some lofty, elevated art form. We're talking about rock and roll. I mean, it's not supposed to take days or weeks to make records or to come up with a song. I mean, it should be something fairly spontaneous, and I would have thought the majority of people writing pop music or rock music, you know, would be drum up something within a few hours or a day or two at the most, and I'd be very suspicious if somebody said they were working on a 3.5-minute song after a week. You know, they still hadn't finished it. I'd be thinking, well, getting a little bit too self-conscious and deliberate. So, I mean, I tend to like to work more quickly. And again, another point of reference would be that the Thick as a Brick album was actually written and recorded in its entirety over a period of less than 3 weeks. No, that was absolutely true. I mean, that was I would be working on ideas in the morning before I left work. I mean, left my home in London to travel down. In fact, we were rehearsing in the Rolling Stones rehearsal studio in South London. And I used to spend about 2 hours in the morning thrashing out another idea or two, rush down to rehearsals, work with the guys on that idea, and that would be rehearsed and added to the piece during the course of that day. And after about 10 days of rehearsal, we went in and recorded the thing actually very quickly. And in fact, it took longer to prepare the album cover for Thick as a Brick than it did to do the music. The band were all very involved in the arrangement on that. It was very much a band effort, so it was pretty fast and furious. But the point you're making about trying to include something like that in its entirety but within the context of something else is exactly the problem we have with Thick as a Brick and Passion Play when it comes to doing stage concerts now, because a lot of people, I mean, I get asked, not every night, but, you know, most nights I meet somebody backstage, you know, some, whether it's media people, disc jockeys or competition winners at radio, whatever, but somebody says, why don't you play a bit of Passion Play? You know, why don't you do this? And, you know, it's our favourite record or whatever. But it really is very difficult to take little pieces out of context, because it doesn't seem to be... It doesn't do them such justice as perhaps they deserve. And you're sort of left sort of taking a little piece of a jigsaw puzzle out and trying to make it into a piece of fine art in its own right, which is very difficult to do.
I think she was a middle distance runner. The translation wasn't clear. Could be a budding stately hero. International competition in a year. She was a good enough reason for a party. Well, you couldn't keep up on a hard track mile. While she ran a perfect circle, and she wore a perfect smile in Budapest. Hot night in Budapest. We had a cozy up in the old gymnasium, dusting off the mandolins and checking on the gear. She was helping out at the backstage, stopping hearts and chilling beer.
Yes, and her legs went on forever, like staring up at infinity. Through a wisp of cotton panty, along the skin of setting sea. Hot night in Budapest. Cut the heat, feel it back with the wrong side of a knife. Feel it blowing from the side fills. Feel like you were playing for your life, if not the money. Hey. One night in Budapest, she bent down to load the ice. Up some more warm white wine in, like some weird unearthly vision. Wearing on a t-shirt, pants and skin. You know it crippled just a hint the muscle, but the boys and me were heading west, so we left it to the late crew.
All those other albums over the years, I've always been fairly hands-on at the mixer, without getting in the way of our most often used engineer, Robin Black, because obviously you have to have a sensible relationship with an engineer. You can't sort of walk all over him and say no, and start fiddling around with the snare drum equalization or whatever when he spent hours working on a snare drum sound. So you have to give the guy, whoever it is, you've got to give him a degree of autonomy in doing that. You may express verbally what you're looking for, but you can't sort of start taking the physical control away. But nonetheless, we should be to delegate a certain amount, so particularly in mixing. My preference has usually been for manual rather than automated mixing, because I like the idea that mixing the final stereo master is a bit like a performance in its own right, and it has all the excitement and the drama and the tension of a live performance when you do it that way, whereas the automated mixing, where you're able to just do things one little bit at a time and just you know, go back and have things exactly as they were on the last attempt, apart from, you know, a tiny bit of change in level of a tambourine or something. It's all, it becomes a bit academic. And I rather like this sort of slight sort of one-off performance idea of doing live mixing. And now when we do records, I mean, there's usually three or four of us working on a track together. And in fact, they are the musicians. And contrary to expectation, you don't have the bass player pushing up the bass guitar trying to make sure he's heard. I mean, if you give people the opportunity, they're remarkably unselfish about the way they will treat the mix. I don't think there are too many negative things about it. I mean, first of all, it isn't a state-of-the-art studio that I have. Thank you, but it is actually very much what would be termed a budget studio. I mean, it's a 24-track studio, and I mix, down to digital, although it's an analog multi-track. But it's pretty budget equipment. It's just something that I came to the realization, having built from scratch, you know, from the ground up, two 24-track state-of-the-art top-line studios in London. I mean, I did learn quite a lot about building studios, the establishment of studios, both in the technical sense and in the business sense. And when I decided to go and work at home, it was really for one major reason, which was that I was becoming very disenchanted with the idea of spending as much as 3 hours a day travelling to and from the studio from my English home 50 miles to the west of London, and you know, having a wife and children and so on, it, there are hours in the day that you start to realize are fairly precious to you. And I decided to install some equipment at home initially, really just to kind of play around with rather than do anything too seriously, but I did that for a few months before I then made the decision to sell my English recording studios and just equip my small home studio with some slightly more sophisticated equipment that would allow me to do what I believed. And I think I've demonstrated my own satisfaction that I could make records just as well from a technical point of view, using a lot simpler and cheaper equipment than I would have to have if I was impressing professional clients in a studio that was being rented out to the, you know, to the public. I mean, well, you know, to other rock musicians or whatever. Because you have to not just be state of the art. You've got to be one step ahead of the game if you're going to charge top rates. And that's the only kind of studio to run, basically, is the best. And you really do have to have all the toys all the time. You know, anything comes on the market, you've got to have one. And it's a never ending trail to economic oblivion, because you find that the amount of gadgetry coming on the market is simply so much that if you're to have it all, I mean, you just simply would you use very little of it, you see, at any one time. You just have to have it in case somebody wants it. You can't rent it in because it's never available when the client wants it, you know. And it's just become, I think, a very... It is not a sensible business move, in my opinion, to open a recording studio in this day and age. I don't think, certainly in the UK anyway, I don't think that anybody ever makes a return on that investment. It's only sensible if you are a record company or you are a very much in demand, hard-working producer, or you're a publisher or something of that sort. If you can justify having a studio for your own convenience and make it break even, then fine. And that's really what I set out to do as a musician, was just to try and establish a business that would not lose money. I mean, having got the thing into profits after a couple of years, that was coincided with the point where I thought, no, I just don't want to have to do all this travelling. And anyway, I was working all the Sunday sessions and starting at midnight, you know, when other people had finished, because we ended up having to just fill the downtime since it was being run as a business. And, you know, the nice thing about working at home really is that you're able to have the seclusion and the privacy when you want it, but at the same time, if... you know, if something else needs to be done, you know, want to spend a couple of hours with the kids or something, then you can just step outside the door and it's that much easier. But it does demand a fair degree of personal organisation to work that way, because obviously it can be very distracting, the home environment, if you're trying to work in it. So you do need to be organised. You need to have an understanding family environment that can accept the fact that you've gone to work, effectively. But you are only just, 20 yards away through a couple of doors. You know, it's tempting for everybody to want to disturb you a lot. But they have to accept that, you know, once you go in there and close the doors, you're in there for 8 hours at a time. It's just that you know you can come out if you want to, and that makes the difference. Now, I think when you're talking about pure commercial sponsorship, then that really does worry me in the context of rock music, because we're seeing a dangerous swing now, which has been, I think, greatly aggravated, if that's the right word, by the Rolling Stones' current tour, towards the level of sponsorship without which the tour simply would not take place, with the economic gains to the artist that the artist is demanding. I mean, the idea of selling a tour to a global or at least a national promoter, the promoter simply can't make money. I know this because I've talking to promoters in Europe just before we came over here who had been offered the Stones tour for their various countries, and they were all very upset about it. I think the fact that the Stones will find it difficult to do over there what they've done in the USA, but I'm quite sure the ultimately one or two of the promoters will cave in and go along with it just out of greed. But basically, the promoters have no chance. And these are guys who've been in the business as long as I have, for the most part. And what they're being asked to do is to do it for almost nothing at all, just for the prestige of having the Stones. And the only way they can actually take the tour is to basically sell on to a major sponsor who is responsible for then funding the entire thing. Because there is no way, on the basis of ticket prices versus what the Stones are asking, that they can actually break even. That's what they're telling me. Now, I mean, I'm only repeating as hearsay what I've been told by those major promoters, or at least two of them, three of them. And the word is bad, because I think what we're happening is, you know, what we're going to see happening is that the likes of the, I mean, Budweiser over here, who knows what it might be in Europe, but it seems to me that when you're actually selling to a sponsor, a commercial sponsor, who is actually going to underwrite substantial losses in terms of what it has to pay the artist, what it costs to put the show on, so on and so forth, and whose benefit is advertising a product and the cold, harsh reality of trying to sell it to a certain demographic, a perceived demographic, a certain bunch of people who will buy that product, then it seems to go against the spirit of what rock music I always thought was about, which was that there were agents, there were managers, there were bands, there were promoters, there was the audience, the venues, and it was a very symbiotic relationship between all those entities. And I for one, would, you know, be a little worried to see. I mean, if the Stones are doing it now, then, you know, and what this does worry the promoters. Next time out, you know, it'll be Bruce Springsteen, Tina Turner, and everybody's going to be jumping on that bandwagon saying, no, no, we just want a flat fee, you know, naming the earth. And the promoters either have to say, no, we don't want it, or yes, we do. If they don't want it, then obviously the band go to somebody else. And there's always somebody there crazy enough to take the job to make a loss just again for that prestige of being associated with it. And ultimately, if you get promoters doing it who are the Johnny-come-latelys jumping on the bandwagon to try and take a deal that nobody else wants, they will necessarily be the less experienced and the less capable. And the ones who lose in the long run are going to be the audience, because they're going to get perhaps not the production, not the quality of show, not the, you know, things will go wrong. And this does worry me as a growing trend, and I'm pretty much against it. Having said that, I mean, as one of the last great surviving laundry bands of the last few decades, we are thinking about talking to the Woolite Corporation about sponsorship deals, since you know, we can heartily endorse their products, since it's one that we all use. And in fact, my hands are still slightly wrinkly and warm from plunging my both arms into the bath and the sink, taking care of my laundry back at my rather expensive Chicago hotel, because it is a rather expensive hotel, and so is the laundry service. So mean, prudent Scotsmen such as myself, you know, tend to take care of laundry in the old-fashioned and time-honored tradition of getting our hands wet.
In a market town, she fillets her soul and washes it down with sparkling wine. A nice girl, but a bad girl's better. Qualifies in both ways, to my mind. But now she's kissing Willie. She shows her leg, shows it damn well. Knows how to drive a man right back to being a child.
Batgirl's better. I can read it in her cheating eyes. I know that in a while, well, she'll be kissing Willie, my best friend Willie.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
Living out of a suitcase is not that much fun after a couple of weeks, because it's a very small world that you have to pack in there. And, you know, hotels can be okay sometimes. Sometimes quite nice to be on your own and just, you know, just you and the Woolite and CNN or whatever it is, you know, takes your fancy. Most of the time it isn't fun, no. And I mean, at this point, I've been on the road. So, after 2 months, it is hard work touring. But let me qualify touring as being the geographical necessity of getting from one concert to the next. The bit that's fun, you know, or at least is most of the time fun, and the whole point of the exercise, is the relatively easy and tension-free couple of hours between 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock every night while we're on stage, because that's the easy bit. You know, that's the bit where your muscles are loosened up. You know, you're in the whole sort of biological clock is geared for maximum output around that point in the evening, and things, you know, you go about it with a degree of anticipation usually. So, I mean, that's okay. But the rest of the day is not fun. It's fun maybe for the first couple of weeks of a tour, and it might be moderately amusing for the last few days just because the end is in sight. But the geographical part of it, the actual physical travel, especially if, like me, you're not a happy flyer, and in America particularly it means flying every day, then it honestly isn't much fun. I really don't enjoy it. I never did enjoy it very much. I certainly don't enjoy it at all now. But it's what you have to do if you want to play concerts to people. And the alternative of, you know, going overnight by bus or, you know, hiring a private jet or something, I mean, all these alternatives we've looked into time and time again, it still comes down to the only sensible thing is just to fly scheduled airlines and hope for the best. No, well, I mean, going back to what you said before, I mean, I was probably making it sound as if I was giving the poor old Rolling Stones a hard time just for getting hooked up with Budweiser. And I know you were, but just since you came back to that, I mean, it does occur to me that, you know, someone would say, well, of course he's saying that because no one's come and offered him, you know, $10 million to get behind some product. And the reality is, no, they haven't. I mean, we've had a few offers from people, and they have been in the booze or tobacco side of things, and I've not wanted to go that route. You know, I don't feel that is right to be seemingly promoting those sort of products, although I both drink and smoke myself, but I certainly wouldn't want to advocate that was a thing that everybody else should do. However, I mean, the point is, if somebody came to me and did make a major offer, I mean, I would find it, I would be weighing it up on, on moral grounds at the end of the day. And I like to think that I would turn it down and say, no, thank you very much, but I think the concerts have got to be something divorced from that sort of, that kind of very obviously commercial kind of exploitation, which is the way it seems to me it is. So, you know, British Airways, for example, came along, then it would be very nice... be very nice to accept their hospitality and be upgraded to first class or something, you know, for the price of an economy ticket. But given the amount of cargo I fly around on British Airways anyway around the world, usually carrying salmon rather than people or electronic equipment. But once in a while I do get lucky, as it is, without having to endorse anybody. So, no, I mean, the... No, but back to the travelling thing. I mean, you know, it's just one of those facts of life. I don't think anybody really likes it. Nobody really likes it. We all have to do it. And at the end of the day, the payoff is the couple of hours on stage, and that's what you're there for. And you just have to grit your teeth and bear up with the rest of it. But what, I mean, I'm complaining. What about the average guy who probably has to drive 2 hours in rush hour traffic, you know, to his job as a bank manager in the city every morning? You know, I mean, that's he's got it worse than I have, probably.
There's a black cat down on the quayside. Ship's lights, green eyes glowing in the dark. Two young cops handing out a beating. Know how to hurt and leave no mark. We're down in the half-lit bar of the hotel. There's a call for the last round of the day. Push back the stool, take that elevator right. Fall in bed and kick my shoes away. Kick my shoes away. Kick my shoes away. Rocks on the road. Wild sound of the city. Hear a call for the young boys heading for a fight. Long distance telephone keeps ringing unengaged. Wonder who you're talking with tonight. Talking with tonight. Who you're talking with tonight. Rocks on the road. Tired coming wakes me in the morning. The shower runs hot, runs cold, playing with me. I'm up for the downside, life's a bitch and all that stuff. So come and shake some apples from my tree. I have to pay for my minibar manners. Itemized phone bill. Well, now how about some heavy road and move these rocks on the road? On the road, rocks on the road. Crumbs on a breakfast table. The little things to spoil my day. How about a little light music to chase it all away? To chase it all away. Thank you.
There's a black cat down on the quayside. Ships lie, its green eyes glowing in the dark. Two young cops handing out a beating. Know how to hurt and leave no mark. Down in the half lit bar of the hotel, there's a call for the last round of the day. Push back the stoop, take that elevator ride. Fall in bed and kick my shoes away. Kick my shoes away. Kick my shoes away. Rocks on the road. Kick my shoes away. Kick my shoes away. Rocks on the road.
Well, it is very strange because I very rarely. I mean, the owners of the pub I know quite well. In fact, they now attend, you know, concerts if we're playing anywhere around. But no, it was just. I mean, it's not a place I go in because it is difficult to go into a place as public as a public house, especially if you are on the jukebox without. I mean, all it does is ruin everybody else's day as well because you get them the wrong. You know. People will then start coming there because they think you hang out there and they can meet you, and it doesn't really do anybody any favours. So I don't frequent any place of that sort, although I do like to go out and eat out occasionally, or not so much to go out and drink, but certainly I like to get out to restaurants and places once in a while. But I don't make a habit of going to the same place all the time, because otherwise you do become part of the floor show, or you're expected to be, which is not really on. Well, let's just think, how many letters in the alphabet? 26, and there's 217 Jethro Tull songs. I'm not quite sure if you can manage to get an A to Z of Jethro Tull, but it must be pretty close to it, so there's a theme for you. Wow. Well, that's why I actually had, we had a lot of, so many letters from fans who say, well, we can't, you know, some of the albums didn't have the lyrics printed on them, you know, and a lot of people want the lyrics, so we decided we would do a lyric book, just something. Not as a flashy sort of, you know, glossy kind of expensive thing, but just literally something as cheap as possible, just at a production cost for the fans who keep writing and asking for lyrics. So I had to sit down and actually go through the whole lot. And
were you surprised at that number?
Well, I was. I never actually counted them. I mean, I suppose if you figure sort of it would be close to that because of the number of albums and number of tracks involved, but... you know, maybe say 18 albums and 10 tracks an album, then you're 180 for a start. But it's a staggering amount, out of which, I mean, of course, quite a big chunk of it is complete and utter rubbish. well, it's not really complete and utter rubbish, but there are definitely songs in there that, I mean, I really feel, you know, very naive or simplistic. And, you know, the songs that I know are just really not up to standard. But... The terrible and frightening reality is that some of those songs that I personally would have a great loathing for is somebody else's favourite Jethro Tull song, and that's a scary thing because you realise that your way of judging it is actually irrelevant. It's what other people like that's important to them, and so the ones that I personally just don't like, we just don't play on stage, or we would never consider playing on stage, and we hope that. You know, we don't get asked for them too often, but no, it's got to be the case. I mean, if out of 217 songs or whatever it is, if there were 20 in there that were on a par with, you know, should we say, other examples of rock classics such as you hear on the ever-growing number of classic rock radio stations, both here and regrettably now in the UK as well. I say regrettably, I'll tell you why regrettably if you want to bring that up later on, but You know, if 20 of them were on that sort of level of being worth hearing every Sunday afternoon, you know, next to Stairway to Heaven or whatever, then I would consider that I'd done a pretty good job.
Winds howled, rain spit down, all these nights playing precious games. Cheap hotel in some seaboard town, closed down for the winter and the whispered names. Puppy dog waits on a big moon sea, snap our heels, how hard to live. How come you know better than me that this is not love? No, this is not love. Drugstore, postcards freeze, sunburst images of summer's gone. Think I see us in these promenade days before we learned October's song. Out on the headland when gale whips tree, curious head bent to see. And how come you know better than me that this is not love? This is not love. This is not love. Yeah. This is not love.